One other point on this. Some people believe that the decision of the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka rested in some way on some social science evidence that was footnoted somewhere. Well, it doesn't really, but in any event, I mean, it doesn't within the terms of that opinion. But what a terrible risk that entails for blacks, to the extent that people believe that their enjoyment of non-segregated schools, non-discriminatory schools, rests on some social science research based on the reactions of white children and black children to white dolls and black dolls. We're not talking about social psychology. We're talking about the most fundamental thing a human being could have. What's the basis for it? What if we have new social science coming out of some college, maybe better conducted than the one that was summarized in that footnote, that shows, in fact, that segregated schools are better for blacks, better for whites? What if segregated schools are better for Inuit? I mean, the enjoyment of your rights, the way in which you govern yourself, has to be based on something more fragile, transitory, less subject to, I'll use a word, sophistication, the kinds of cleverness that lawyers on the other side or on your own side or somewhere, you know, can reduce the thing to some kind of babble. You're talking about what's most important to your being who you are. Got to decide who you are. Got to decide what's absolutely indispensable for doing what you want to do. Then you have to be ingenious. And I mean, good Lord, the law changes all the time. If Indian society is dynamic, what are you going to say about the law? Aren't there ways? I mean, are there no forms of? I know nothing about this matter, and it's obvious, I suppose, now to everybody. Are there no forms of cooperative and collective organization in which people can organize their lives and do it within the general framework of the law? But, you know, you've got other things going. And that's why I raised the question about pride. You don't want to pay taxes because you don't owe anybody anything. Well, you're not going to pay. Indians not taxed. They're in a special category. Yeah? You want the advantages of taxation, of other people's taxation. You want a special status. You want to give special preference to your own people. These are hard things to accomplish under a law that prides itself. I'm not speaking now about the hypocrisy of it. I'm talking about the principle of it that prides itself on its colorblindness. And it's not knowing or caring who your daddy was, or what his status was in the old country, or what your color was, that speaks to you as a human being and tries to secure your inalienable rights. It's a hard thing.
Joe Jorgens. Yes, Thomas Jefferson thought that the problem would be resolved, and that is with the native peoples, so soon as admixture took place, as soon as all Indians married whites, and there would no longer be a problem. That would be one way to address it and to get back to the problem of individual rights and individual rights under the law. But the very problems that you pose, and I think David Case has made it clearly, you've joined the debate, that the whole sweep of Indian legislation in behalf of Native Americans, has played with this very, very serious dialectic between individual rights and group rights. In fact, I could be corrected, but I even think that the Brown versus Board of Education was decided on the Commerce Clause, not the Equal Protections Clause. Is that correct? I think that it went to the Commerce Clause, didn't it, Kim?
My understanding is I think it was equal protection.
I think not, but anyway, you can correct me later. Okay, 2-1, I give. The Commerce Clause of the Constitution, I think, is important in the debate nevertheless. I thought I had an extra point there. The values that become important in the majority view are individual values. They were, I think taxation without representation had something to do with the revolution, even perhaps more than a religious freedom or natural laws. I think, too, that when the United States government came to deal with natives in the embrace of the territory that they claimed for themselves, and it constantly grew, that they recognized, and I'll be firm now, the sovereign states, these nations with which they had to deal. Even in the Northwest Ordinance, when they said that people cannot be claiming territory in the Northwest Territories until such time as the federal government had worked out the procedures whereby you could purchase land from those Indian nations with their consent, and only with their consent. One of the first groups of speculators to beat the Non-Intercourse Act of 1790 and to make claims against the suggestions of the Northwest Ordinance was George Washington and others to speculate on land in the Northwest Territories. There has always been a pull for commodity, for individual gain, for each person to make his own way, accumulating capital if he wishes, to the best of his abilities. Dealings with Indians to purchase their land, to sign treaties with them, treaties that often were not ratified, treaties that were usually discussed in English, treaties that went back to the Senate, usually to be revised on the floor of the Senate, many, many miles away from the Indians who had perhaps agreed to another version of the treaty, only then to be signed and come back, often were not the treaties that were agreed to by a consenting Indian nation. This came to bother the House of Representatives by 1871 and their constituencies. Indian nations, Indian tribes were being dealt with as groups, as collectivities, as groups with rights, with properties that were not being used. This is all what I said yesterday. And there was a change. Congress took it upon itself to put a rider on an appropriations bill in 1871 to deny treaty-making powers further to these Indian nations with which they dealt. And so we plunged into a long period of dealing with Indians as individuals, protecting them, letting them make it as individuals, only to have it spin around again, and we got some more group rights back. But the old treaties, some were still in force, some came to be argued in the courts, recognizing that there were group rights and many of them reserved, only to be challenged again, this constant tension to terminate tribes, to extinguish their claims to title to land, to push them into the mainstream. This precipitated some waffling policies, and here we are again, claiming what was recognized when the nation was founded and prior to it, that sovereign nations had the rights of property, of self-governance, and when they came under the embrace of the United States government, this weaker power did not give up its right to self-governance by taking the protection of the stronger power.
You cover a very long period, almost a century, and without distinguishing which sentences have to do with which period, I want to say just a word about the Northwest Ordinance. in restricting settlement in the Northwest Ordinance, the Continental Congress was asserting its authority to regulate the public domain against freewheeling entrepreneurs, against land companies who had, through fair means or foul, secured special licenses from the various state or colonial governments. They were trying to establish a public domain. They wanted this principally with a view to two things. One, to have orderly progression westward as white population grew and Indians were prepared to move along, with a view to avoiding the kind of reckless behavior. You know, nice people don't move to the frontier. I shouldn't say this in Alaska. When I say nice, I mean square. Okay. These are usually people who, you know, who have the don't tread on me mentality, right? So they're likely to do things their way and ask questions later, if ever. And of course, it's exactly the presence of such people in that kind of a situation that can lead to a war with very formidable Indian tribes, a war that could stretch for 1,000 miles, and where you wouldn't even know about that war till 2 months later, when it was all too late. And partly because, I'm still speaking about the motivations of the Continental Congress, partly because they wanted to sell that land under regular ways that it established, that they established, as a means of paying off the crushing debt of the country. The United States was a debtor nation over its ears in debt and had all these mighty loans to pay off to the French and the Dutch and the Russians and whoever else they could put a bite on. Okay.
There's a couple of other questions. Oh, did you have a couple of other questions that occur to me? The discussion has proceeded from premises of political philosophy that animated the Founding Fathers, and David Case and Joe Jorgensen have tried to persuade you that there was another stream of political philosophy that was not clearly articulated in the constitutional documents, but which acknowledged the political entities that were known as Indian tribes. But you still assert that the genius of the U.S. Constitution proceeds from its recognition of the rights of individual human beings, and you seem to reject the legitimacy in the U.S. political thought of any other idea of the origin of human rights. In Alaska, and I'm trying to summarize, I hope, doing rough justice to all what the discussion has thus far elicited. In Alaska, ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, and provided, did not make provision for political institutions for Alaska Natives. It did provide for economic institutions, native corporations, in which the sole shareholders are native persons and other persons are prohibited from having shares issued to them, and shares cannot be sold to other persons. So the only persons entitled to be enrolled as shareholders for 20 years, from 1971 until 1991, are native persons. Do you have those are not political institutions, those are economic institutions, but do you have any observations to make on the propriety in terms of your own notions of U.S. Political theory of that?
It's very strange. It's not strange to imagine why they wanted to do it. But imagine our notion if a government-financed corporation, whatever, any government-financed corporation, of which there's a multitude, issued stock to which it said, no Irish need apply. Be very peculiar. And people might take umbrage. They might not like it. Clearly, this is something exceptional. Clearly, it is a special favoritism toward a particular people. I don't know that anyone would challenge it. Maybe someone would. But it's so much, in a way, at odds with the general notion that government operation works indiscriminately on the population at large, in terms of the general population. But I think it's to be understood, some recognition, that Indians are really a special case somehow. Special. Please, I said something that struck you as wildly wrong from your expression.
What exactly is it that you thought was favoritism toward Alaskan natives?
No.
Is that what you meant?
I'm not saying. There they've gone again. They've given those Alaskan natives something that they don't deserve. It's just outrageous. I repeat, not saying that. I am saying that they are introducing a principle of discrimination that otherwise American law, in dealing with the general population, rejects. We do not permit, welcome legislation that singles out groups as groups for preferential treatment to the exclusion of others.
What preferential treatment did you have in mind?
That only Indians may be shareholders.
Well, how about all the millions of acres of Indian title that were extinguished? What kind of preference does that show?
You're confusing, to my mind, if I may say so, two different considerations. I'm not saying what would have been the case in Georgia if an Indian had wandered in, or if someone who wasn't an Indian had wandered in as an agent for an Indian and said, okay, I'm buying fee simple title to this parcel, and then I'm buying the other parcel, and so on. It probably wouldn't have sat well with the Georgians in the 1830s. But did the law forbid it? You could say the practical situation of the Indians was that many or most or the overwhelming proportion weren't in a position to buy anything. The point is, it wasn't a law that excluded them from purchasing. These are always difficult things because one is reminded of what happened with people who went that great American route, the Cherokees. Okay. They're doing everything right, so to speak, and it didn't help them. I'm not talking about that. But the letter of the law did not say this is for this biological or religious group only. That is, in the non-pejorative sense, discrimination. I discriminate, I distinguish you from the next guy on the basis of this thing. Not because you are Coulter and he's Naranjo, but because one of you is Indian. Well, I mean, it's a mistake, okay? I mean, I could take another example. Between you and me, okay, let's leave it that way. Because you are Indian and I am not. That's a new consideration. That's a discrimination. And I say, and to the extent that there's a benefit, look, I mean, let's not forget the obvious. It's a benefit to be a shareholder in this corporation. If it weren't a benefit, you wouldn't worry about people selling it off and it being bought out by Japanese or Saudi Arabian investors who want to recycle their dollars. And they want to have a good investment. And they'll come to Alaska and make resorts. If it weren't a good thing, you wouldn't worry about it. Isn't that true?
No, I don't think it can be counted a benefit to be spared the evils of theft. I mean, I don't think it's any discrimination to say that only you should own your sport coat. That's ridiculous. It's your sport coat, and to say that others don't own it is no sort of benevolence or favoritism toward you.
That, sir, and is because the law establishes my claim to my sport coat. On the theory that it's somehow mine, my individual property, whether I earned it, whether I bought it at a salvage shop, whether I found it on the streetcar, I mean, it doesn't go into that too much. But if it were a challenge, I suppose somewhere or other, I would have to establish that I do indeed have a right under the Constitution to this thing. I, Lerner, have a right to this thing that I'm passing off as my property.
Well, now, when did the Alaska Native people have that chance? And isn't it true that Congress not only claimed but exercised the power to extinguish the Native claim to millions and millions of acres of land that they claimed by natural right?
You used natural right earlier.
Legal right. Call it anything you want. I don't care.
But you see, it is different. As far as I know, the Indians did not before claim that their right to the law, to the land down in the 48 rested on the white man's law.
Well, who cares what law it rests upon? What difference would that make? They claim to own it.
It only cares to those who pass on the law, like judges and lawyers.
Well,
they're
so in other words,
they're so narrow-minded about this thing.
Who's narrow-minded?
All these judges and lawyers. They seem to care what the law is. They don't think they have a license.
In my view.
Well, I know, but you see, that's the peculiar thing. You're operating within another man's setup. If the court, to paraphrase a famous remark, were authorized to sit like a qadi, that's an Islamic judge, under a tree dispensing justice, well, that's okay. But they don't have that license. They are authorized only by the language of Article 3, Section 1 and 2. As specified by the Judiciary Act of 1789 as amended. Well, they can't just do anything. They're not supposed to just do anything that strikes them as a nice thing to do. You wouldn't in your heart of hearts want to give anybody the right to do just anything he damn well pleased on the grounds that he's a nice guy, because he might not always be a nice guy, and his successor might even be a rotten guy. So you keep him to the letter of the law to the extent you can. That's not a small thing. That doesn't deal with the question that you're stirring here.
This was never before a court. We're talking about it has been in some limited instances, but the court said that Congress can just steal the Alaskan Native lands if they want and pay nothing at all. Now, that is, to the thinking of many people, exactly what ANCSA accomplished. And to be sure, it did set out that Alaska Native peoples and corporations retained certain other rights, which you now feel are a discriminatory benefit.
I'm not going to get hanged up on this, because I'm only suggesting, and when I used words like discrimination and benefit, I was trying to use it in ways that reach beyond the passion that one has, that not only have I got this coming, but I haven't nearly got enough that I have coming. I'm trying to invite you to step back from it for a moment. And I was responding to Mr. Berger's effort to elicit some kind of notion of how this thing, this statement that only Native peoples may be shareholders in this government-financed corporation, how that sits with the vast other body of the law, which says we don't pick and choose among people in that way when government action is concerned. I'm not saying that the Russian Orthodox Church hasn't got a right, if it floats some kind of bond, to limit purchases to Russian Orthodox believers, and even to establish a test oath to make sure that they're really Russian Orthodox and not, you know, guys who are pretending to be Russian Orthodox but are actually working for somebody else. That's another matter. You're talking about a government for all the people. Now, again, it's a special thing, and I think it recognizes the specialness of Indians, but or of Native peoples generally.
I can't think of any other group that would ever be subjected to that kind of legislation.
I wonder, Professor Lerner and Tim Coulter, Kim Gottschalk's arm is going to fall off if I don't recognize him.
Well, I just think this is a perfect example of what we were talking about before as individual versus group rights. You want to know where this fits in with the whole body of law, and Professor Johnson answered that earlier. The way it fits in is the way that the Supreme Court rationalized it is, they said when they allow only Indians to own this stock or natives or whatever, they're not granting an individual preference and there is no discrimination. Now, I realize that somewhat, in some ways, that's a hard concept to buy, but what they said is they're dealing with groups of people. They're dealing with Indian tribes, not individual Indians, and therefore, when they say only natives may hold this stock, they're not granting an individual discrimination. They're discriminating on the basis of groups with certain rights vis-a-vis individuals, just like in Morton versus Mancari, when they said there can be Indian preference for jobs in the BIA, that was not granting an individual preference over another individual. That's the way the Supreme Court has fit that in with the other body of law that you're talking about, which generally says that everyone must be treated alike.
I have no interest in, in reconciling the many things that the Supreme Court says about any topic in particular, let alone one as complex and multifaceted as Indian law. Nor am I saying that it's a bad thing. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing for Indians to control their own corporations. I'm not saying anything about that. I'm just speaking about the problem of dealing with this under ordinary concepts of American law. And to the extent that you've got it, you're lucky. And to the extent that you can do something about keeping it, bonne chance. That means good luck in English. And but beyond that, the notion that this supplies an entering wedge for reconstituting the whole basis or status of Native peoples under American law, that's a very tall order. When you have Indian corporations that will be big in the wood pulp and paper manufacturing, salmon cannery business, there's no reason why they can't go into microcomputers or anything else that people who make corporations might want to go into. You're going to have interesting questions down the road.
Excuse me. I think Rosita Worrell should have the last question this afternoon, and we'll and just before you ask it, Rosita, I thought that tomorrow morning, when we returned at 9 a.m., we would ask Ted Chamberlain to lead off, and I thought after Ted, Alma Yupiksoon, if you wish to make a contribution then, we will welcome it. The same goes for Kim Gottschalk, and of course for Daley Sambo, and of course for Alfred Starr. Mr. Starr, you, sir, have been with us now a week and a half, and You participated fully last week, and I don't want you to think that we don't want you to speak tomorrow if you wish. And after that, I think Browning Pipestem will be here, and we will ask him once he's got his sea legs and knows what kind of a round table this is to participate. Rosita, we'll have time for one more question before we give up the room.
Again, you might have answered this question when I was out feeding my meter. Speaking non-lawyer to non-lawyer, okay.
Gratitude.
In your analysis, how do you move from this individual rights to collective rights? We here in Alaska, within the last several years, have heard how we must yield to greater interests, national interest needs, and the rights of other people outside. But it talks about a collectiveness. And in your mind, in your analysis, how do you move from individual rights to these group or collective rights?
What you have are group or collective interests, and they are the things that are dearest to you. For example, you have an interest that your children should somehow be what you would like them to be. I suppose that under law you have a right to federal funds for one thing or another. I've got little sense of this rabbit warren of legislation that exists in these matters. I don't know how successful schools are in Alaska. I've got a pretty clear notion about how successful they are in Chicago. I think that probably if something really mattered to you, that your children should have it or somehow accept it or be exposed to it, not as a piece of a museum exhibit, but as a life lived, it wouldn't be a thing that you would entrust to a school teacher on the public payroll. If it mattered to you really, you would do it. You would live it. You would make sure that it was done right. I mean, when you deal with people with marginal interest in your interests, who've got a lot of other things on their minds, who may or may not be competent, may or may not care, you wouldn't entrust it to them. You wouldn't expect them. I mean, it's if I may touch a subject of over which people go crazy. Will one minute of public silent prayer in the schools convert a school population of atheists into the believer in the Almighty Living God? Who can believe it? If that child learns about the meaningfulness of God, it's going to be what that child observes in the behavior of those who are closest to it, what they do and how they do it. So I don't know, how you secure the things that are most important to you. If you can get money, get money. That's all right. But the real control over your lives probably has to go at a level much more fundamental than the usual bureaucratic establishments.
Could I just make an observation before we depart? I don't know whether anyone wishes to return to this tomorrow, but I leave it on the table. Professor Lerner, in his remarks this morning, referred to something that people often do refer to, that is, they are surprised to find on Baffin Island or on the Bering Sea or anywhere on the frontier, they're surprised to see the manifestation of the universal culture of the West. That is, the Eskimo girl listening to rock and roll is perhaps not by Professor Lerner, but by others seen as somehow impairing her standing as an Eskimo. you know, you could go to Nepal, the Himalayas, you can go to the South Seas, and you will find that that the universal culture of the West has penetrated there. A week before last, this commission held meetings at two villages on the Bering Sea, Monik and Tununik. At one of those, Tununik, I think it's safe to say people are largely engaged in making a living off the land. And we had, we ate muskox and dried fish dipped in seal oil, and I mentioned those things to show that substance of the land, even on a two-day visit, loomed very large in the ordinary events such as eating and so on. Yet every home has a television set. You can watch As the World Turns, or The Man with Red Hair on Late at Night, two programs that I noticed were available there. Nightline, that's what I'm thinking of. Well, does that in any way diminish the way in which you would characterize the those people? And certainly, the evidence they gave to the commission indicated that the presence of and you know, the Ayatollah Khomeini cannot stamp out blue jeans and rock and roll. The Kremlin.
He'll give it a good try.
Well, the Kremlin is unable to do so. So where does that leave us? Would it make any difference if the Eskimo girl was listening to Beethoven? Would that? Daily Sambo, you wanted to see something before we adjourn.
Just as a side note to that, the reference that you made to the entertainment at the ICC conference, it was country and western, it was rock and roll, it was in Inupiaq, Inuktitut, and Inuvialuit languages. It was not in English, and it wasn't with a southern drawl.
And what did the words say? As well, distinguished from what the music said.
Well, some of the tunes were adapted to music that was that came from the hearts and minds of the Inuit people living in those areas. But again, some of them were translated from the English versions.
All right. Well, I think that we're indebted to Professor Lerner for uttering some propositions that we all know in due course have to be considered, and we're grateful to you, sir. And 9 a.m.
That's where it sits at the moment, and they want to give everybody plenty of business to make sure.